Welcome to Ottawa. I've just come from England, where the grass is green and the crocuses are popping up. England goes from autumn to spring. Sometimes you get some snow, but basically it's a different climate. So if you're into snow, don't come to England. Or if you're into skiing or things. The monastery I'm in right now, we are in the midst of a 3-month retreat. Because the monastery I'm in is quite active in the community, we have a retreat center and we have a lot of guests that come. We do a lot of teaching. We're invited to to go to Europe, to the continent, and so on. So we've got a busy place. We try to spend a good portion of the winter on retreat. And this year is the first time we've done a 3-month retreat. The Sangha there is in the midst of a 3-month retreat, which is a very special time for us. I've come back to be with my mother. She's 82, and I decided last year that I would try to spend this month with her because winter is so depressing for elderly people because they can't get out and they're so fragile and walking in the ice is frightening for them. So I try to do this every year. So here I am. Which is very rewarding for me too, to be able to care for her. So it's an opportunity for me to try to offer some reflections on the teaching. And once again, Buddhism is a path of personal reflection. It's not really something that one should just believe in, because believing without questioning, without trying, is always limited. One has an idea of about something, but one hasn't really tasted it, one hasn't tested it, then there's no real freedom or liberation. So whatever I do say is in the spirit of reflection and contemplation. If the hat fits, then wear it. If not, don't worry about it. The teaching itself is very rich in many aspects. And one of the things I always like to emphasize is that one of the things to remember in Buddhism is some of the teachings talks about our social relationships, the way we live in society and how we operate and what our responsibilities and duties are in society. And then some of the teaching is about our inner world. And teachings, if you get that confused, sometimes Buddhism sounds perhaps socially passive sometimes, or even self-obsessed, because there is a lot of emphasis on in developing the inner world about awareness of what one is feeling, attention on one's emotions, developing skills of calming the mind, many things like that. And also there's a great emphasis on acceptance of the inner world, and from that acceptance one can do things, one can work on oneself. And when those kinds of suggestions are translated into the social world, people sometimes think, well, that means I can just be very passive and accept everything. And it'll be all right. But Buddhism does require, it's a very high teaching, actually. It's very difficult. It has a very high standard of social responsibility, moral responsibility, social engagement, things like that. Very, very high. One of the main things that the teaching emphasizes in the way we relate to the world, we relate to each other, is empathy. And empathy is this wonderful quality we human beings have of putting ourselves in the shoes of others. If I see someone suffering, I have the capacity to try to contemplate, what does it feel like this person in suffering? Or if I see someone who is experiencing joy, I have the capacity to put myself in their shoes and think, good on them, they're experiencing joy. And this sense of empathy, in Buddhism we call it the Brahmaviharas, but it's a quality that the Buddha was always trying to encourage in human beings, because this is where we go beyond selfishness, one of the emotional ways that we go beyond selfishness, empathy. I have a lovely room in the monastery that faces south, and I get a lot of sunshine, a lot of light, and there's a lovely garden outside my window, and we have a bird feeder we put up in the autumn, and we have hundreds of birds coming. And this year I have three rats, three and many squirrels, and I've really grown to love these rats. And the first time we put up the bird feeder, I quite often sit and have a cup of tea and look at this bird feeder, and the birds have last chance at it, the rats and the squirrels have a first go. But the man who usually puts the food out had put out a lot of bread on the bird table, and the birds, some of the pigeons had knocked it off, the bread, and this rat appeared. This lovely rat, and usually rats have got a bad press, don't they? Bubonic plague and so on. They've never lived that one down. So, but this rat came out of the bushes and was kind of sniffing around in the cold, dewy grass, and it came upon this big piece of bread. You know, and it grabbed this piece of bread, and it jumped up in the air, I'm sure with joy, and just leaped like this into the bushes again. And I felt this incredible joy for this rat and this piece of bread. Now, maybe that's a romantic interpretation of the rat's mind, I don't know. But certainly it was joy, and he did have his piece of bread. And that's empathy, isn't it? Now, in just beyond my garden, there's a kind of a ridge, and then beyond that there's a big field where a lot of us do walking meditation. Now, I've never seen a rat sitting up there watching us do walking meditation and contemplating, oh, how wonderful, they're meditating. I've never quite noticed that. Because the rat's usually just concerned about the bread and procreation and things like that, and escaping from the magpies which chase it, and simple things like that. So we have rat-like qualities in ourselves, and the psychologists are forever telling us about that. But we also have empathy. You know, we have this kind of capacity to step out of our selfishness. We have this capacity to not just be self-obsessed, but to be concerned about other beings, and to experience joy at the success of other beings. And this is lovely. This is a very beautiful human quality. And in our, and when we engage in the world, and when we live and so on, we have to recognize our rat-like qualities, and we need bread too, and we need to feed ourselves and so on. We have animal instincts, but we are more than that. We're more than just a rat running in a cage or in a maze. We have quite a high potential, really. So to cultivate qualities which are wholesome, which are noble, is important. But within the sort of sober realization that we also have, we have animal qualities, we have habits which aren't skillful, which aren't beautiful, which aren't empathetic, which are self-serving, which are self-obsessed. We have all of that too. And so the other quality that the Buddha emphasized a lot is the quality of discernment or reflection. This is another quality we have. So, like with our rats, we also have a big kitchen and a huge larder, because we have about 50 people that live in the monastery. And we also have four cats. Now, if I was really silly, you know, we could just say, oh, aren't they sweet rats? Why don't we just let them live in the larder? And we set up nice little beds for them and put some straw down, and we might have a bubonic plague then, I don't know. So there is also discernment, isn't it? It's not just living in a kind of romantic, silly, sentimental life, but there is wisdom, there is being streetwise, there is the ability to understand limitations. And that ability to discern is, we call it panya in the Pali. That's a terribly important quality, discernment or reflection, being able to reflect on the way things are. And then making decisions and living in a way according to that. So those two, discernment and empathy, I think, are a kind of a balance that we are always trying to cultivate. Because discernment and reflection, if it doesn't have heart, it becomes very judgmental. It becomes very cold. It becomes very critical because it lacks heart. Heart without discernment becomes sentimentality. It becomes a kind of romanticism which doesn't really fit reality and harms us. We become naive or sentimental. But both are necessary. Buddhism emphasizes a lot the practice of awareness. To be aware. Not just of walking along the street and not slipping on the ice, but to be aware of life in a very total way. About my heart and my reactions in the world and my responsibilities and how things work and so on and so forth. Now, what I found in my own practice over the years was that my beginning, that awareness was actually, it lacked heart. It tended to be judgment. I tended to judge the way things are rather than noticing the way things are. That's a huge, huge difference for me. When I judge the way things are, I'm already in a kind of critical stance and posture. And I think I'm being aware of, but I'm not really aware. I've already made a critical assessment of it, and I think, well, that's right and this is wrong. So say classically, Buddhists, if they're not aware but they're judgmental, then they'll think it's wrong to feel anger and it's right to feel love. So when you feel love, you think your practice is well, going well, and when you feel anger, you think you're a rotten Buddhist or something, which is a critical judgment. Discernment and empathy functions in a different way. Discernment knows that anger feels this way, and discernment knows that love feels this way. And discernment knows that to pursue anger brings an angry mind, brings angry results, brings suffering, and to pursue love brings a loving result. Right? It knows cause and effect. But it doesn't say that anger is wrong per se, or that love is right per se. It just says it is that way. It just feels that way. Love feels this way, anger feels that way, and that noise feels that way. Could you close the door? Could you close the door? I think they're playing bingo or something. And so like in the Satipatthana Sutta, which is a very interesting sutta on mindfulness, in the third section on cittanupassana, which is mindfulness of the mood of the mind, the citta, it says the practitioner knows the confused mind is the confused mind. The practitioner knows the expansive mind is the expansive mind. The practitioner knows the jealous mind is the jealous mind. Just knows. And this sense of knowing the way things are is the beginning of Buddhist practice, which is acceptance. It's accepting the way things are. And that's not social. Like at a social level, I can close the door, right? Because I have some power around here. I'm giving the talk. But at an inner level, this is the way it feels. And this is where Buddhism gets confusing. Where people sometimes confuse Buddhism and say, accept the way things are, and then it's a kind of, people think, well, that means you'll just let the bandits run over you. But it's not that. It's not that. It's socially, there is this ability to say, that's right, that's wrong. But inwardly, we always need to begin with some sense of acceptance. This is the way it feels. This is the way it feels to be angry or to be loving. Only from that can you get, I think, right practice. Because if I approach my inner world with a judgment of the way things are, how can I really understand if I have already made a judgment that something is wrong, how can I understand it? I cannot understand. I need to be with it. If I see a child and the child is doing something and I say, you're wrong for doing that, but I haven't really investigated why the child is doing that, then I don't really know where the child's at. And I'm just reacting to what I think is right or wrong. If I know what the child, if I ask the child and I figure it out, then I can criticize or I can encourage. But I've actually, first of all, I accepted from which you can get edification and instruction and whatever. Same with our minds. Same with our emotions. You know, there has to be this sense of acceptance of the way things are. And that's what we mean by the heartfelt quality of awareness. That awareness does have heart. And so many of you have practiced a lot, and many of you traditional Buddhists, you know, one of the things to investigate is what is your attitude to your own karma? You know, what is your attitude to the reactions you have to the world? Not just your reactions, I mean, you know, need to know that, but what is your attitude to those reactions? So one attitude to unskillful reactions would be to rationalize them, a kind of lying to oneself. And you see, I read a lot of history, and I read about great generals or great politicians, and how they make, from the accounts you read, they make some very egotistical mistakes, and then they spend the rest of their life writing books rationalizing about it. and you can just see this kind of lying going on in people, just lying about what their true motivation is. So that kind of using the rational mind to justify one's greed, hatred, and delusion, that's not awareness. And that, of course, leads to a bad result. Because it leads to more and more suffering inside and outside in society. On the other hand, just making harsh judgments about one's negative states of mind. I shouldn't be this way. I shouldn't be greedy. I shouldn't be angry. I should be more loving. I shouldn't be jealous. I should really love Canada, but I hate the snow. And you know, whatever the mind brings up, and that should or shouldn't, that's also a judgment, and that's also not mindfulness. Well, mindfulness, awareness, awakeness is an opening. It's more like you open the mind in a kind of welcoming way to the way things are. I feel this way. This affects me this way. Then from that you can work. You know, you can cultivate that which is wholesome. You can abandon that which is unwholesome. But you cannot cultivate wholesomeness from lying, being dishonest, or from aversion, because already those mind states are unwholesome. It can't work. It has to work from a kind of purity of intention. So, if we begin that way with what awareness is, that it does have heart, then you begin to realize that there is a quality of self-empathy, which sounds maybe a bit strange because empathy sort of implies other people, but an empathy for one's own predicament. In other words, when you feel anger or you feel fear or you feel, you know, all the kinds of suffering that we human beings feel, that one is willing or able to say, gosh, this hurts. This really hurts, this anger I'm feeling. Which isn't a kind of self-indulgent, just feeling sorry for yourself. That's not it either. But actually, coming to the situation, and just like I can feel for the suffering of a child who's maybe, you know, fallen and sprained an ankle or something like that, also I can feel empathy for the predicament of this being, the suffering of this being, the difficulty that this being's going through. That's not feeling sorry for himself, but that's applying a heartfelt awareness to one's own limitations, one's own karma. So some sense of self-empathy. Because in that, there is the ability to feel fully one's suffering, feel fully one's predicament, and grow from that, and develop through that. So I would ask you, in your own practice of awareness, like, what is your attitude that way? You know, as you observe the habits of mind that you are, that you have to work with, karmically, what is the attitude to that? Is it harsh? Is it rationalizing? Or is it an open welcoming to what what life brings to you. One of the difficulties of developing the purity of the heart, of cultivating a mind which is joyous and which is compassionate, is just the force of habit. I don't know about you, but when I observe my inner world, I observe that actually there might be a myriad of situations that I am involved with, different kinds of people and so on. But actually the avenues that the mind, the habitual avenues that the mind travels down, actually are not that many. You know, it might be like worry. So I have a lot of responsibilities in the monastery, so like worry or aversion. You know, once I've, too much stuff has come at me, I tell people to, you know, shove off. Leave me alone, I don't want any more problems, aversion. It's not very many patterns. The objects of, say, like anxiety or worry might be different each day. I might be worried about one of the monks having a difficulty with meditation, or I might be worried about some confusion with the lay community, or I might be worried about my own health, or I might be worried about the finances of the monastery. The objects of the worry might be, you know, many, many, but actually that avenue that the mind travels down, that habitual avenue, you know, there are very few like that. At least that's what I find. And part of the life of awareness and inner understanding is to begin to just, to not always just believe in the objects of greed, hatred, delusion, not just to believe in the person I'm irritated towards or the thing that I am greedy for, but just to look at greed, at hatred, at worry, at fear, as habits of mind. And when you can do that, then you begin to be a kind of step removed from the urgency of life, from the immediacy of life, from the compulsion of life, from the pull of the world. When I can be worried about something and say to myself, wow, this is a worry, without denying my responsibilities, but I can just say, worry feels this way, then already I have a chance, a much better chance of understanding that habit of mind and going beyond it. But if I'm always just worried, where is there any chance to be free? Because if it's not one thing, it's another thing. And my mind will begin to just go down these avenues of suffering. And breaking those habits is quite hard. Yeah? And so that's, I think, in terms of self-empathy, realize that even if you have the intention not to be angry, say, for instance, but you've got a habit of anger which has been there for 30 years, that habit's going to grab you. You know, it's going to grab your attention. It's going to grab all your best intentions and you'll be angry. There's nothing right or wrong about that, just the way the mind seems to work. It's the flow of habit. And so the very, very important thing about habit is to see that what makes a habit, what gives a habit power? If you look at your own mind, what gives worry power? Or take resentment. Resentment's a good one. So let's say someone betrayed you 2 years ago, okay, in a very awful way. And it was a real betrayal. It wasn't just your perception of it. They really got you. Stabbed you in the back and then twisted a bit, right? And so your resentment is quite justified. You know, it's quite justified. But you still got it in your mind after 2 years. And even though it's justified, you're pretty much fed up with it. Right? So you finally decided, I don't want this anymore. Okay. Now the earlier you do that, the better. But let's say it's 2 years down the road. Then how does something like that work? Well, it works with memory and associative thought, isn't it? So say, it's around that time of year when the knife was thrust into your back. You know, let's say Christmas or something, and then everyone's happy at Christmas, and you got tortured at Christmas. So Christmas, the memory of Christmas brings up the joker that got you, right? And so there's memory. Memory comes into mind, and then what does memory do? Well, memory triggers off a certain kind of thinking pattern. And then that guy, he did this to me, and I'm never going to forgive him, because that was such a, and I'm never, and then the mind takes one thought, and I'm going to kill the guy, and I'm going to go and stab him. Whoa, what's going on here? And then you try to suppress it. You try to be good. Right? You say, Merry Christmas, may you be happy, and And then you suppress it all, and then the memory comes up again. And then you're caught in that whole train of associative thought, aren't you? And it just goes on and on and on. But what we try to do then in meditation is to actually, first of all, just like bring up into consciousness, this is a feeling of resentment. Now, that doesn't sound like much, but quite often what we'll do is this: I shouldn't feel resentment. It was 2 years ago, so this is silly. You know, this is ridiculous. Now, come on, Viridhamma, grow up. You shouldn't feel resentment. But that's not awareness. That's a judgment that I should not be resentful, which is nice, which is better than, like, shooting the guy. But it's not yet awareness. Right? Awareness is resentment feels this way. And that's the big step. And then if you really look at that, can resentment be sustained without thought? Can you sustain as an example, or a worry, or whatever you want to take, can you sustain that without thinking? I can't. If I have the memory of the person, I might have a gut-felt feeling about, you know, sort of the memory, but what I need to do to keep that going is to think about it. I need to, you know, one thing conditions another thing, then there's that memory, and then they did that, you know, and then they did that to that person, and then they did that to that person, and your mind can go on for days. But what sustains it is thought. If you have, like, what I've noticed is if I have a strong emotional reaction from memory, I can notice that in the body, and I can bear with that, and that can cease. But to keep the resentment actually going, I have to think about it. I have to keep putting attention on it. And that becomes a habit. You know, whether it's worry or resentment becomes a habit. And then each time resentment comes up, I fall into the same way of dealing with resentment. Or each time worry comes up, I fall into the same habit of worry. So what we do in meditation or in contemplation is we, like, let's say if you have some resentment around a person, then what we try to do is bring up the perception of the person. So Joe Bloggs, I hope no one here is called Joe Bloggs. And you just bring him up into the mind and just hold that perception in your mind, Joe Bloggs. And see, where can it go? It can't go anywhere but into silence, if you're very attentive. Without trying to get rid of it, you might have a strong emotional, physical feeling, but it can only, maybe your experience is different, my experience is, I can only keep resentment of Joe Bloggs going by thinking of Joe Bloggs, by bringing up a new perception, and then saying, yeah, he did that, and another one, yeah, he did that, and yeah, he did that, and yeah, he did that. But if I just bring up that thought, Joe Bloggs, and the perception of that, it can't go anywhere. Because what fuels it is wrong thinking. What fuels it is wrong thinking. Now, that happens so quick in the mind that we find quite often that we get into days of Joe Blogg resentments, or days of worry, or days of self-doubt, or days of depression, or whatever. But just the nature of thought and attachment is terribly important, very, very important. So then I ask you to consider, what kind of habits of mind tend to occupy your attention? And what kind of, like, worries? Now, worry has a function. So say, you know, you smell, you know, you're at home and you're watching TV and you smell something burning in the kitchen. And, you know, the worry comes up, and you say, burning, yes, burning, burning, perception of burning. Okay, what's on TV? And the house burns down. So, I mean, there is a function of worry. It has a reason for being there. But what's the difference between the natural fears and anxieties which exist to protect us and neurosis? What's the difference? Like if you hear a sound outside and someone is tapping on your window at night, and you're going to do something about it, obviously. But what's the difference there between just worrying about what's going to happen next year, or resenting something that's happened to you, or fantasizing about something that you're going to do? So within the kind of rat-like nature of our minds, we have fear, we have greed, we have anger, and these are very natural things. There's nothing wrong with them. But through the ignorance and not understanding life, we attach to things, And we become enslaved, don't we? We're bound by the chains of our own habits. And this is the thing that we try to unravel as we live spiritual life, as we live the religious life. Try to unravel these things and no longer believe in them, no longer get lost in them. And this seems to be a lifetime work. You know, Buddhism is at least one lifetime work. It's not just a kind of fad, you know. It's not sort of something you pick up and put down, because it's life, isn't it? It's understanding yourself and going beyond your own limitations. Now, in the sense of witnessing to the way things are inwardly, we tend to function on the pleasure and pain principle, don't we? So if we feel insecure, that's unpleasant. There's an unpleasant feeling, so we want security. And one of the ways we get security is by worrying, say. You feel secure if you worry. That's why people worry, because thinking about it seems to make you feel more secure. But it doesn't, because as soon as you think out the solution, you quite often get another worry, if it's just kind of neurotic worry. If, say, like resentment, someone's really hurt you, and you go back and take it home, and then you stab the person with your mind, that feels good. Revenge feels good, doesn't it? Huh? Let's face it, it does. If you've been done in the office, right, and they, you know, someone was more quick with their tongue than you were, and you were put down, you get home, you're feeling that, then what do? You think, oh, I would have said that. I could have really embarrassed them. The sort of sense of revenge. And now that's pleasant. That's pleasant to do, isn't it? So there's you get maybe the memory of someone who's done you a bad turn. That's unpleasant. So the mind likes to go from the unpleasant to the pleasant. So then it does something. It does a bit of revenge. Right? Or you feel insecure. And then that's unpleasant. Then you worry, because that's pleasant. Believe it or not. Well, why would you worry? Why would we worry? I mean, why would we do that? It's stupid to worry. But it must have some kind of profit, because it somehow takes away the feeling of anxiety quite often. So then what we try to do in Buddhism is actually begin to contemplate the unpleasant, to begin to feel pain. Not in a kind of way of self-mortification, you know, like stab yourself, things like that, but to begin to feel the natural pain of life, to begin to feel like, what does it feel like to be insecure? What does that actually feel like, to feel unsure? And to begin to witness to that and not go to the pleasant. Now, I'm speaking about the heart. I'm not saying, like, go outside, feel freezing, and say, this is unpleasant, and then get hypothermia. That's not the point of it. But in all the kind of things that we experience, to begin to feel like, what does it feel like to feel hurt? What is that feeling like? Now, the desire mind doesn't want that. The desire mind wants pleasure, and it doesn't want pain. So then the desire mind escapes from that. But actually to feel the pain or the discomfort of insecurity, say, if we're talking about worry, to actually feel that in the heart and to be with that is very difficult. To not make a judgment about it, but to feel, what does it feel like? But when we do that, and we go against this, the habit of desire to get away from it, run away from it, to distract it, what we experience is what we call nirodha. And nirodha is synonymous with nibbana. And nibbana is the cooling of the fires of desire. Now, when you feel something like insecurity, and when you're willing to be with that, and you don't buy into the desire mind just to be secure all the time, and you're just willing to be with that, then what happens? That insecurity eventually ceases, because it cannot have power. Its nature is to change. And in the cessation of that insecurity, you realize a very peaceful mind. But not a mind which is distracted, not a mind which needs pleasure, but a mind which has transcended pain and pleasure. That's the principle of liberation or enlightenment. The loneliness, say, I'd like to talk about that one, because in monastic life, we monastics experience a lot of loneliness. Say, living a celibate life, not having the opportunity for intimate relationships, men and women feel very lonely at times, very lonely. You know? And no amount of community life helps you. In fact, when you feel more lonely, you think, community life, I don't want it, I want relationships, I want intimacy. And many, many disrobe because of that, which is fine. But actually, then, to go to loneliness, say, don't you feel the feeling of loneliness? It's very difficult. Because the desire mind wants intimacy, wants love. And that's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But inevitably, in all our relationships, if you have kids, you spend all your life raising your kids and then they leave. They're gone. And there's a vacuum and there's loneliness. Or, you were in love with someone and then after 20 years you're not in love with them, which is pretty natural. And you feel lonely. And then, of course, with someone across the street, you're also lonely, so on. But actually to go to loneliness, and this is, the desire mind doesn't want that. It wants pleasure, it doesn't want pain. And again, I'm not saying that to have loving people is wrong. It's lovely. But all of us feel lonely at times, don't we? Yeah? And to actually then stay with that, to be with the feeling of loneliness, and which is a very, very unpleasant, to say the least, state of mind, to really feel that. But to go to that in a very mindful way, in a way of empathy, self-empathy. What is that? What I've discovered that does, that more and more takes me to the sense of silence and peace. Not because I found someone to fill the gap of loneliness, but because I've been willing to endure the pain and the desire to get away from the loneliness. Longing is a very human emotion. Longing for the beloved, longing for God, longing for whatever. To go to that, to go to the sense of longing, what does that feel like? And to be fully with that, and mindfulness is that, to be fully with something, to embrace that difficult kind of emotion, takes you to the emptiness or silence of the mind, not emptiness in the sense of vacuity, but empty of need. And from that is actually a fullness, the fullness of being able to respond to life. Now where this is very difficult is with wrong thinking. So you feel lonely, so there are thoughts of loneliness. Or we feel fear, there are thoughts of fear. Or feel anger, thoughts of anger. Feel greed, thoughts of greed. And the mind just keeps not looking, keeping kind of busy and active, and caught in all of that. And so mindfulness is kind of stepping, getting deeper into the heart. Not just being caught up at the thinking level. Getting deeper and feeling these things, very, very, very real things, and then learning how to find that which knows all these things, because that's our real refuge. I'm watching these poor people in their Olympics. My, what a torture that must be, trying to win, and the flu, and the broken ankles, and it's so kind of. I admire the people for doing that, but it's so insecure, isn't it? I've heard that Elvis has the flu. Now, imagine it, all that work. And if the poor guy gets the flu and some little microbe does him in, the microbes win again, right? And one senses the kind of the courage of these people to go into all of that. But when you contemplate the insecurity of life and the unsureness of life, what is sure? Where can you find stability? Where can you find what is for sure? Now we try to get for sureness with all kinds of security things. So, we try to build good electrical systems and so they don't get knocked out, and which is good, which makes life possible. And so that's this wonderful society which is able to rebuild its whole electrical system in a month or two. Amazing. Which is quite phenomenal. It would never happen in many countries. But what is really, what is it, that you can really rely upon. You know you can't rely upon electricity in the winter now. you can't rely upon your body. You don't know what that's going to do, especially as you get my age, get my mother's age. You can't probably rely upon other people because they have the same difficulties. What can you rely upon? What is for sure? Well, Buddhism would say, what is for sure is awareness. Now that doesn't sound like much. Big deal. Thanks a lot, you know. It's gonna feed me when I'm 64 or whatever. And obviously you need pension plans and you need all of that. But what is it that you can rely upon? And that's this ability to know, to be awake, to be aware. Because that really can take you through everything. You can the human, you know, we're so adaptable, really. But if you seek security spiritually in that which is insecure, which is changing, then you're always going to worry. On a social level, yeah, you try to find security in pension plans and good housing and good friendships and good government in a civil society. But at the spiritual level, the only security you really have is in the sense of knowing the way things are. And when you begin to intuit that and live in that, fear, worry, anxiety, all of those things begin to fall away. And your expectations of the world begin to be, you begin to not to attach to expectations. Now the one of the things in the sense of the painful things we experience in life, the Buddha often recommended is contemplate disappointment. That's a painful thing in life, disappointment. But disappointment's one of the great teachers. It's what it's showing you is that if something disappointed you, then don't rely on that. You know, so if your body disappoints you, don't rely on it. Take care of it like you take care of your cat. But don't rely on it because it's not your refuge. Or your emotions, don't rely on them. Rather than feel guilty about feeling anger, just don't expect yourself to always be loving. Just begin to find that the true refuge is awareness. So whenever you feel disappointment, it's teaching you something. It's teaching you that there's no refuge in the world. The world is changing. It's nice sometimes. It's fun. But it's not secure. And so the spiritual refuge is in the sense of knowing the way things are. If you feel lonely, say, and you feel loneliness, you know the way loneliness is, you found refuge. Not another person, but in that which is beyond loneliness, because knowing is not lonely. Awareness is not lonely, is it? Awareness is not strong or weak. Awareness is not happy or sad. Awareness knows. Awareness is transcendence. And nibbana or nirvana or liberation or God or whatever the different words are, the path to that, the gate to that is awareness. Awareness is the path to God, to the deathless. Whatever way we talk about the ultimate truth or transcendence. They're very simple, really. But we get fooled by our habits. We get kind of kidnapped and deluded by them. So the practice is to continually just awaken. I feel this way now. And the judging mind says you shouldn't feel that way. And then you know that. And you know that. And you know that. And you know that. You keep knowing, knowing, knowing. And you begin to find that the peace of the mind, which is not subject to change. That knowing doesn't change, it just knows. But the other things keep changing. Emotions, society, that all keeps changing. And that's what we mean by taking refuge in Buddha. It's not some kind of cultural thing. It's very, very, it's very existentialized. Okay, I'll leave that for contemplation. If anyone has any questions, please. Yes?
And I find it very scary. I have been reading probably more extensively than it's good for me. And of course, I'm on the karma chapter right now. And my understanding through my readings is that anyone who is in suffering of any kind around me has probably karmically brought this on themselves. So a mantle of guilt has settled down on my shoulders. In addition to one of the various ones that I've already. I'm just wondering if you can address this issue of karma in a way that will
That's a kind of, what's the word in philosophy? A reductionist view, simplification of the whole idea of karma. One thing the Buddha apparently said is that there are several imponderables, he called them, things which are unfathomable. And one of the things which is unfathomable, which you can't figure out, is why this moment is the way it is. All the variables here, why you're here, why I'm here, and why, you know, I've got my head shaved and so on. It's too complicated. It's too complex. So then you get these kind of reductionist views, especially New Age things, which say, you know, you chose your mother and father. That's a popular one, isn't it? You chose your mother and father. You know, you're sitting on a cloud up there, and there's Astrid and Bert. Yeah, okay, I'll take those two. Bang, you're down. You know, which is very, very deluded kind of view. First of all, it doesn't say anything about who you are. You know, like, who is this guy choosing? And I mean, so you get these very simplistic views. Karma, say, means volitional action. Basically, means volitional action. And vipaka is the Pali word, is the result of volitional action. I'm making intention, volition, and I'm thinking deliberately, may they drop dead, may they drop dead, may they drop dead, may they drop dead. And that creates a result in my mind. And the result is one of a tendency towards resentment plus a certain social relationship to this person, an unforgiving feeling towards that person. And whenever I see that person, or whenever that person's mentioned, my resentment button gets triggered, and I go, boom, 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 into that resentment. That's karma. Right? And that's something I can see. I can see it, if I'm more subtle, I can see it in my body. I can see maybe how when that button is pressed, I get tense. I can see it, maybe it obsesses my mind. I can see how I gossip about it, so on and so forth. That I can know for sure. And that's really what we work with karma. Other things like past lives and future lives, that's very speculative. Some beings seem to have the ability to see into past lives. You read about it, you know, you meet people, I don't. And much of that is kind of speculative. But I think the real practice of Buddhism, the liberating practice of Buddhism, is very much about this moment. It's not speculative. So what you can know, when you read something which says that, you know, whatever you've done is because of, you know, you killed a rat in a past life or whatever, and you feel guilty. What you can know right now is that you feel guilty. That's all you can really know, that this kind of teaching has conditioned this kind of feeling of guilt. And the karma there is not to feed the guilt. So if your mind then starts to think, oh, I'm a terrible person, I did this and I did that, just begin to watch. That perception of guilt can only be sustained through thought. Now, if I actually did something really cruel to someone, you know, I really tortured someone or something, and then the feeling of remorse and guilt came up, then I'd have to feel a lot of memories, and then the tendency would be very strong, and I'd probably drink or take drugs or something to get rid of that. So that karma would be stronger that way. And that's something you can work with very immediately. So I would suggest in your readings, anything which is too speculative, don't worry about it. You know, look at teachings which are very immediate and which are helping you with your life. And that's like when you started, you said, I probably read too much. It's true. It's a difficult one because Buddhism has so much teaching around it, you kind of want to plug in. And so you read a lot and then you get kind of confused by it. But it does take, I found it, it took a long time for me to get all the different factors together. So I suggest reading stuff with it which helps you just to work with the very nature of your own predicament. And not to get too theoretical. Because then it just gets very head-centered and intellectual. So I think the basic teaching of the Four Noble Truths, if you can find text around that, suffering, its cause, its end, and the path, that's very practical teaching. That way. But karma means intentional action in thought, speech, or action, or bodily action.
Is that tough?
Yes, it's a little one of something else.
Uh-huh.
And it really bothered me to think that if people were indeed suffering from either sin that they believe in this life or have that, then I would have to address the idea that children who have various forms of maladies or illnesses wouldn't understand that they were paying for something that they did in a past life.
And yeah. Or fatalistic.
Yeah.
Yeah. But you don't know. You don't know. I don't know. You know, did everyone in the Titanic, did they all kill rabbits in the past life or something? I don't know. Yeah. And that, I think that's the beauty of it. I mean, people have opinions of that. And the you know, the really, like, I could lay a heavy opinion on you. Yes, it's true. But all you'd know, and all I'd know, is it's my opinion. I could be very authoritarian and say, like that. But you know, look at that. Look at, like, speculative stuff. And what, you know, what do you actually know? And yet what you know is very little. You know, it's the opinions we have about it. Like, look at perception, say. I like to observe perceptions, how they build in the mind. So now I'm observing my Mr. Blair perception. Right? Now I have a Maggie Thatcher perception. And I'm watching Mr. Blair's perception build in my mind. And I've never met the guy, and I'll never probably meet him. And I don't think he's going to do any of my retreats. You know? And yet, I think I know who Mr. Blair is. But, you know, all I really know is that's an opinion. It's conditioned into mind through the media and through what people have told me. And Buddhism is trying to get right down to that level of, you know, that's just a perception that arises and ceases. And around it, there's silence and space. So the perception that, you know, everyone in the Titanic, you know, was involved in some genocide in the 16th century, someone tells you that, fine. It's a perception that arises and ceases. You don't know. And then you can use Buddhism in a good way, in a very, very good way. Yeah? And take what works, you know, in Buddhism. But, I mean, if something challenges you, okay. Don't just take the easy parts. Because some people will do that. Well, I don't like that bit. I have to give something up. I'll take this bit. So, I mean, take the challenge, too. Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, have you ever had insight? Where you see something end, you understand something about yourself. And what's the feeling there? Feeling of release? And I think the joy of freedom is more like that. It's you know, joy has a kind of very emotional sound, bliss. So you know, you read about Ramakrishna and this kind of bhakti, it's kind of over the moon all the time, and you think, wow, yeah, that's it. But there's a kind of coolness about it, I think, and a peacefulness that one comes to first, I think. And then you notice that in the instances of insight. And when you don't grab something, like, I think we were talking about something the other day where you found yourself not reacting or something like that, you know, and you begin to see a kind of non-reactivity to old habits, and you see an old habit die and cease, and you realize the mind is just very silent and empty and peaceful. Well, but what you find is if you're very attentive to the cycles, their power, amplitude, frequency begins to end. You know, it's like volcanoes changing to hiccups over 20 years. 30 years. But it's true, isn't it?
Long-term
investment. Yeah. but you know, like, if you start to look for an emotion, you're finished. You know, as soon as you start to look for something, you're in desire. So, what a lot of people don't understand, at least in monastic life, is you have to surrender. You have to surrender to loneliness. You have to surrender to despair. Not in an abject kind of indulgent way, but you have to really go into that stuff, which is hard to do, because people say there's something wrong. You know, if you're feeling despair, you want to say there's something wrong. And the Buddha will say, well, just despair. Bear with it. And to kind of go into that stuff without getting lost in kind of depression is, you know, it's quite a hard thing to do. It's very awake. Passivity would take you into thought. You'd just be, you know, if you felt despair, you'd just be thinking despairing thoughts. Oh God, life is a bummer. That's not being aware, that's thinking despairing thoughts. Whereas awareness is despair feels this way. And then there's, you know, whatever. And then the mind starts to think, God, I'm never going to be bitten out back. So it's a very awake, very attentive kind of practice. And they're not thinking about it. No, it's very alive. Yeah. Andre.
I've heard some instructions to the effect that practices like the practice of loving kindness, which are intentional thoughts or repetition of some phrase, can be used as antidotes to things like anger, for example, sort of like a medicine or something you take. Can you explain the role of that kind of practice in the context of
awareness?
I'll
give you, like, let's say cynicism. I've worked a lot with cynicism, and cynicism is a kind of negative state of mind, right? And it's basically, for me, it was a kind of put down of the world, which was a way of me feeling like I knew something. And what I found is I constantly awakened to the fact that I was just in another cynical judgment of the world, which is a kind of aversion. It's not like anger. And so I thought, now how am I going to work with that habit? There's the habit, I see that habit, but I keep getting overwhelmed by it. So then I could see that what I needed was a stronger background of compassion. So then I started to do a lot of metta practice. So I'd sit every morning, in the morning, in the evening, I'd start my meditation with thoughts of loving kindness. May I be well, may all beings be well. And I'd really try to generate that. And then I'd try to generate that thought throughout the day, right? And then what I found was that created a kind of atmosphere of mind, which was accepting and empathetic rather than critical. And then within that atmosphere, when the cynical habit arose, I noticed it more clearly. Because the habit of cynicism was still there. You can't get rid of it. But as it came up into the mind, because now there was an atmosphere of non-criticism, I could see it much more clearly. And because I could see it much more clearly, I could see it more in its arising phase rather than having been lost in it for, you know, 10 minutes or so, whatever. And if I could see it in its arising phase, I could say, I could choose, yeah, but may all beings be well. So samadhi, and this is the way samadhi works. Samadhi works to create balance or to create wholesomeness from which you can watch unwholesomeness and imbalance. So its opposite is asubha meditation. Asubha is contemplating the not beautiful. So that is like traditionally meditation on death. So you know, if like I'm infatuated with, you know, I'm obsessed with getting computers, you know, get another software package and another computer and then, you know, some speakers for that and then a bit of bigger hard disk and then another and then it's Windows 96, and then it's Windows 99, and then blah, 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 blah. And so, you know, my mind keeps doing that. I say, yeah, but what if you drop dead tomorrow? Oh, I see. It all of a sudden creates a kind of different, you know, from that obsessed, greedy mind, I get this different kind of atmosphere of saying, life is short, brother. What's really important? Now, like, if I contemplate death, and each time my mind goes into some kind of future scenario agreed, that will help me see it more. Or if I just contemplate, like asubha is contemplating the not beautiful or the decaying. If I contemplate, well, the last time I got new speakers, I wasn't really that happy. Or, you know, whatever it is. I bring that up into my mind. I bring up an aspect of the greed mind. The greed mind doesn't want that. But it creates a kind of atmosphere to help me see the greed mind. And that's the way samadhi's working always. With the breath, you know, you contemplate the breath, you calm the mind. Then when the mind goes into non-calmness, you've got an atmosphere which helps you to see non-calmness, confusion, things like that. So samadhi is very important. And the type of samadhi you do depends on your, you know, the way your mind's working. So we see the samadhi punya, right? But don't do metta practice as a way of trying to get rid of anger. That's where you go wrong. Because then you start to hate your anger. And which is, of course, just wrong. So you think, you know, there's anger, and may all beings be well, may all beings be well. I hate her, may all beings be well. Because it's false, isn't it? It's not sincere. Whereas sincerity would be, this is hatred, and then to hold that without thinking about it. And the thinking mind will try to keep that perception going. You hold that anger, and then you can think, yeah, but may she be well. Then there's complete mindfulness and transformation. Yeah? That's the theory. It's not so easy. Mind's very quick. What else? Anything else? So why do you do it? Yeah, it's a bummer, isn't it? You'd like to just drown consciousness, wouldn't you? So I tell the story a lot. I used to, in my first few years, I just wanted to go to a pub and get drunk. I just wanted to forget about Buddhism and meditation, and just because I was so fed up with the habits of mind. But I knew I couldn't do that, because I knew I'd, you know, have the same habits in the pub, so. But it does work, you know, I mean. But also it gives, you know, I find it like, it's a continual challenge, too. To, you know, to really be with the moment, to really kind of really move away from the thoughts, the thinking mind, to the silence of the mind. I find an incredible challenge, actually. But the first few years were just drudgery. Just a hard grind. But really, what else is there to do but be free? Anything else? Yes.
And awareness.
Well, Pali doesn't use bodhicitta, so what would that mean?
Some sort of noble mind.
Yeah. I mean, it is the noble mind. Because awareness really is what. You see, awareness is totally not selfish. And that's what nobility is about. And attachment, in an instant, is selfishness. And you get lost in it. So in awareness and empathy, what you get is intuition functioning. And intuition is that which joins us to the world. Whereas attachment is that which separates us. So nobility arises from that awareness. And it's only the habit of mind which prevents us from being noble, from the wrong habits. For me, it was very important to see that awareness was not control. It's not judgment. That it is. It has a heartfelt component. That was a big change for me from being someone who was always being aware, walking around slowly and counting my breaths and counting the number of spoons. You know, drove me crazy. To actually just receiving life in a relaxed and open way. So my misconception of awareness was this kind of thinking that I just have to control everything. which you can't do, and it's not life, and it's an awful way to live one's life. But then when I began to contemplate what's the heart quality, and then I began to contemplate the sense of awareness being something, I see it more as a feminine quality. You know, like I like the ideas of one of the ways that in the bhakti traditions they talk about awareness as being the mother of the universe, or the divine mother, or the womb, or that which gives birth and allows things to cease. So it's a very kind of open, feminine, welcoming quality. Where my idea of awareness was more very masculine, kind of suck it to and get enlightened in 10 days kind of thing. And so that open quality, I mean, not speaking as a man, I don't know what, you know, maybe the women don't like this kind of way of talk, but for me that was a very important kind of understanding, you know, to get that sense of, and like in the Prajnaparamita Sutta, I don't know Mahayana very well, but Prajnaparamita Sutta, they call it the mother of the Buddhas, awareness. And this is what gives rise to a Buddha, is awareness. Or the image of like a mother will accept all her children, you know, even the children that go to jail for 20 years, the mother, it's my boy. and so that being that quality of awareness and accepts all the pain and the ugliness and the misfortune and the beauty and all of that in an open way. So I think mindfulness awareness, we really need to see what do we mean by that word. Because we just throw it around so easily, but in our own practice, that seems to me very important. Anyone else? Okay. So, I'll be here for the next few Wednesdays. And also, I think I'll come here for 3 more Wednesdays, so if anyone would like to come, I'll be here. And also on the 7th of March, we'd like to have a day of meditation, if that's all right. Can we use the place? Yeah? Great. It's a Saturday. Yeah. Great. Okay. So if anyone would like. So you're all welcome to.